That was an old Chess Records recording there on, it was called The Joke. Were you laughing hysterically? Were you at least mildly amused by that song, The Joke? The reason we played that here on the Dave's Gone By radio program is that we have a jokester with us in the neighborhood today. First of all, let me explain that my name is Rabbi Saul Solomon. I am the spiritual leader and founder of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am thrilled, as usual, to be on this radio show and extra, extra excited to be talking to Jeffrey Gourion. Jeffrey is a comedian, a doctor. He is also now a co-author of a book called Make 'em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the Greatest Comedy Club of All Time. He co-wrote this book with Richie Tienkin, I assume another nice Jewish boy, and it's interviews with all these famous comedians who got their start, or part of their start, at the comic strip in New York. So without further ado or a don't, please welcome to the neighborhood the one, the only, and we're giving him the five-minute light here, Jeffrey Gourion. Say something hilarious.
Oh, gee, now you're putting me on the spot. I can only say something hilarious when I'm on stage. On the phone, I tend to be very serious.
So make believe you're on stage.
Listen, I didn't know there were Jews in North Colorado, by the way. I thought they were all in South Colorado.
Well, they go to South Colorado in November, late November.
Yeah,
for the frost.
Snowbirds, like the snowbirds in New York. They go to Florida. So in Colorado, they go to South Colorado.
Exactly. Like they spend December, January, February in Pueblo. Then they come back up to Denver in the middle of March. And then by April, they're back here. But me, I stay. You know, I've got my friends here. I've got my synagogue here. I can't go to the South.
We're not good travelers in general, you know, Rabbi. We got stuck on the desert for 40 years.
I know.
Moses must have had a terrible sense of direction.
Well, he always had that headache, which is why God made him take two tablets. Thank you, damn it. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I think I inherited that sense of direction because traveling is very difficult for me. I have ADD, so whenever I'm traveling, I'm always lost. And I'm always asking people for directions, and invariably I get a guy who says, you know what, I know where that is. You got to go south for about 3 miles, and then you got to go east for about a mile and a half. I'm like, what do I look like? I carry a compass?
I don't know, north, the south, the east, the west, the moist.
I always thought north was the way you're facing. You know, if I'm going this way, then that's north.
Right, if you're going forward, it's north. Yeah, if it's you're walking forward, it's north. If you're walking backward, it's south. That's easy.
Exactly. South is always behind you. That's the one thing that I know, no matter which way you're going.
Actually, my tuchus is always behind me. That's what I really know. Anywho,
exactly.
Let me explain, because I didn't have a chance to re-explain, who Jeffrey Gourion is. He is a stand-up comedy MC. He also does a lot of other things like dentistry and healing and things like that. But we're mostly concerned here on this Saturday morning with the comedy part, because Jeffrey Gourion was part and parcel of the comic strip, an important and still existing comedy club in New York that helped shape the lives and careers of people like Jerry Seinfeld and Ray Romano and Paul Reiser and Susie Essman and Colin Quinn, all these people who are, by the way, interviewed and talked about in the book Make 'em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, co-written by Jeffrey Gourion and Richie Tienkin. Now tell me, Jeffrey Gourion, tell us all, how did this book come about?
Well, it was an unbelievable thing. I just want to clarify one thing about the dental comment that you made. That was a tremendous rumor that went around about me, that I was a dentist. And you know when it started?
When you started pulling teeth? When did it happen?
It started the day I graduated from dental school, and it hasn't let up. People keep spreading that rumor about me, and I came from typical Jewish parents who didn't want me to be a doctor. They said, no son of ours will be a doctor. Don't shame us that way. And they made me, you know, I wanted to be a doctor. They wanted me to be in show business. Typical Jewish parents.
No, but did you really, you did get a degree from dental school?
Yes, I was a cosmetic dentist while I was writing for people like Rodney Dangerfield and Joan Rivers and for all the Friars roasts. I did both for many years.
So you were a dentist. You're not joking.
I was.
Oh, okay.
I do admit to that now. So what happened with this book was in 2008, I was at the comic strip with Ann Curry from NBC and Gilbert Gottfried. And we were coaching Ann Curry on how to do stand-up comedy. And she happened to be very funny, by the way. And I was looking at the walls of the comic strip, and I see Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock and Eddie Murphy and all the biggest stars that came out of that club. And I said to Richie Tinkin, who was the owner and the founder of the club, I said, you know, we should really do a book on this. Now, I didn't know that other people had already suggested that to him, and he never really went with them. But something sparked his interest, and he came to my house to talk to me about it, and he saw that I had more pictures on my walls than he had at the comic strip. I've been taking pictures with all the comics that I've worked with for so many years, back through Milton Berle.
Oh, my God.
Milton Berle was my original sponsor in the Friars Club.
All right, you know what? Let's roll it. Hold it, because there's so many questions already that I want to ask. Let's roll it back. Let's go back to the beginning. You knew you wanted to be what? In show business, a comedian. So how did that start, and how did you get involved in the comic strip, and how did Uncle Milty come into this, and how did you get all those naked pictures of comedians on your walls? Tell us.
You weren't supposed to mention that, Rabbi Saul. That was the thing we had made up before. When I was 12 years old, I was writing comedy already, and I decided I wanted to be a dentist. And so my whole life was very confusing to me because I managed, you know, I thought to myself, how can you be in show business and be a dentist? But somehow I managed to combine those things, and I was writing for people for many years. I got started from the original Saturday Night Live crew. Alan Zweibel up there gave me my start as a writer who's now writing Lisa Lampanelli's new show for Broadway.
Oh, my God. And let me say, by the way, this is a complete non sequitur, but the host of this radio program, Dave Lefkowitz, went to the same high school, although years apart, as Alan Zweibel in Woodmere, New York. Just
really?
Thought I'd throw that in. Honest to gosh, yes.
That's such a coincidence. Yeah, he was one of the head writers up at Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And I snuck in there by, you know, in those days I was driving what would best be referred to as a pimpmobile. It was a Mandarin Orange Eldorado that had been made for one of the Isley brothers, and he decided not to take it, and I bought it. And I totally pimped it out way before MTV did Pimp My Ride. I put a Rolls Royce grill on it and straps in the back, just like the pimps drove in New York in the 70s. The only problem was I was a doctor and I was married and living in Scarsdale. And my wife would say to me, we're Jewish and we live in Scarsdale. Why am I driving an orange Cadillac?
What was wrong with you? Why? You know, I have to say this, but not really too. Yes, I am interrupting. But and people who don't necessarily know Jeffrey Gurian or what he looks like, I mean, you have a certain eccentricity. And I guess, what would be the word that you're
no, that's a great
an
word,
exhibitionist?
Because, see, if you're successful, they call it eccentric. If you're not, they just call you crazy.
Well, you're driving this orange sort of Cadillac pimped out. You've got the special kind of cool hair. No offense for me to mention that, but if I had hair...
That's great. And you know what? You should tell your listeners my site so they can see my hair. It's jeffreygurian.com. JeffreyGurian, as in Nancy, .com. And they can see for themselves.
So, but do you agree with that? That not only are you eccentric, you're a little bit of an exhibitionist of wanting to be noticed in a way, which I guess is why you're in show business also.
Well, I'll tell you, it's such a weird thing because when you go to buy a shirt, the guy just gives you the shirt. He doesn't give you a shirt and a picture of himself. But in show business, it's exactly the opposite of the spiritual life that I try and lead. It's all about ego. It's all about telling people who you are and what you do. And it's very important to create the balance between that because it's kind of uncomfortable for people to always talk about themselves, but you have no choice in the entertainment business. You have to tell people who you are and what you do, otherwise they'll have no idea. You can't just hand them a shirt. So in 2000, so way back, I drove this car up to 30 Rock, which is where they were shooting Saturday Night Live, and I threw the doorman a couple of bucks, and I said, Lorne Michaels is expecting me. And in those days, they didn't have security like they did today, because people weren't blowing up buildings at random.
Right, they were just blowing Letterman at random. No, I'm
right,
kidding. Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you.
You could just walk in places. You didn't need, like, a security detail. And so I snuck past the security guard. They always had them, but I snuck past them. I got in the elevators, and I went up to Saturday Night Live, and I showed my films. I was making these little films, little absurd films. You would get this, Rabbi.
Oh.
I did a story about several men were arrested for smearing cream cheese on the ankles of elderly women who wore their stockings rolled down like bagels. You know the elderly Jewish women, they roll their stockings down. It always horrified me. It looked like bagels. So I went to my grandmother, who was such a wonderful woman and did not have a Jewish accent, but I filmed this with her, and she her name was Mrs. O'Goyim in the movie.
Yeah.
And she told me this great story of how these crazy men smeared cream cheese on her fleshika stocking. She says, you know, we have two kinds of stockings, one for milk and one for meat. Milchidik stockings and fleshidik stockings. And this crazy man, he smeared cream cheese on her fleshidik stockings, and she can't get it off. And I zoomed in on her ankles, and there she had cream cheese around her stockings. So I brought that up to Saturday Night Live, and Alan Zweibel saw it, liked it, and sent me to his manager, a man named David Jonas, who died just about a year ago at 100 years old.
Oh!
And yeah. He was married, he was managing.
He should die to 120, that's what we say.
And he could have lived till 150.
Oh my God.
But he didn't. No, he could have, but he didn't. So he was managing Freddie Prinze at the time, and he got him Chico and the Man. Not Freddie Prinze Jr., but the original Freddie Prinze. And that's how I got started writing comedy, because Alan Zweibel sent me over there. And when I saw him recently, he still brings up the cream cheese on the ankles after all these years. It's the kind of visual that doesn't leave your mind.
But wait, one thing I don't quite get. Did you make up that whole story, or were you taking something that you actually heard that a crazy Jewish people were doing, like lunatic Jewish men? Or you just
no,
made that?
No, that was something that I created.
Okay, just check.
Because for many years I wrote for the legendary Weekly World News.
Oh, my God! You wrote for them?
Column.
Wow! Oh, you might... Yeah, sorry,
yeah,
go.
I had my own column called Gurion's World of the Bizarre.
Mm.
And I wrote stories like Man Robs Bank with His Chin, and College Professor Fired for Casually Removing His Spine, because you can't do that. You know that, Rabbi. You can't remove body parts.
Oh, I've tried. My dear wife Miriam Libby removed my testicles 20 years ago and won't give them back. It's just one of those things. So wait, what gigs did you get from having that manager, that agent? Did you get to write for SNL or what?
I got started writing for comedians. He was handling people at the time like Freddie Roman, who is now the dean of the Friars Club.
Sure.
Dick Capri, who was in Catskills on Broadway with him.
Right.
And by writing for them, I got to write for Rodney Dangerfield, who was the first big star that I ever wrote for, who started doing my stuff on television on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Wow.
And that's how my name started to get around. Because I put cream cheese on my grandmother's ankles.
Now let me.
She said, Jeffrey, only for you would I do this, you know. And I used her in several of my films. I did films about the dreaded Masters of Disguise, and I don't know if you heard of them in Colorado, but the Masters of Disguise were two master criminals who disguised themselves as inanimate objects to commit their crimes. So it started as two men disguised as coats rob a hat store. They come in over the arms of two other men and they say, just act natural like we're your coats and nobody will get hurt. And there were many crimes by the masters of disguise. One of them was two men disguised as jewelry robbed a local jewelry store and they come in on the front of a woman's dress. And my grandmother was the victim of that crime. And she gave a great account. She said, I said to her, when did you realize that one of the robbers was a stick pin? And she said, I was looking in this jewelry store window when all of a sudden my jewelry became so heavy that I couldn't stand up. I had to stoop over. And I said, and what happened next? She goes, I screamed, and the security guard wrestled the stick pin to the ground, but unfortunately he got away.
Oh, that's...
Isn't that amazing?
Let me ask you, Jeff, are these videos on YouTube? Have you posted them?
Yes, they're on my Comedy Matters TV channel, and if you're, I have all these videos from the Cannes Film Festival about the men who robbed a bank with his chin, and man with infant's head sues for discrimination, which is a very, very important story that your listeners should watch. It's all on my Comedy Matters TV channel, which is at youtube.com/ Gurian News Network.
Thank you, Bob. YouTube.
Gurian News Network.
Okay, Gurian. Gurian
News.
Gurian.
And there's stories like, you know, man impaled on spike still shows up for work on time. He had never been late for work, and just because he got impaled on a spike, he thought he was going to be late, but he went to the emergency room, and they cut off the spike, and he found that it wasn't that uncomfortable, and he felt he could wait till the weekend to have it removed.
I remember Robert Klein doing a bit about that, saying that he had this spine that he was living with, this thing sticking through him, and he said, well, for one thing, he was more irritable. Well, it was funny when Robert Klein did it.
Your jacket doesn't close properly when you have that, because most designers don't make a jacket to fit over a spike.
And very hard to eat spare ribs. And
very,
I don't know what.
Very difficult, you know. And so I did many stories like that. Hunter lost in wilderness, saved by his mustache. You know, who would ever think that a guy's mustache could become magnetized from being lost in the woods? His mustache started to spin like a propeller and pointed him right out of the woods. Moses could have used a mustache like that when he was lost on the desert.
All right, Jeffrey, let me ask you, though. Yes. Were you there to the end, the end of the Weekly World News? Were you there?
Yes, actually I was. Yeah, I was there until it went out of business.
Why? What happened? Why weren't people no longer buying it? Was it a print?
No, people loved it. It was a legend. I don't know. It was some internal thing. And then it became a website for a while. But the actual newspaper was legendary. It was one of my greatest honors that I had a chance to write for Weekly World News. Even the guys from The Onion loved Weekly World News.
Oh, of course. I mean, it wouldn't have been an Onion, probably, without the idea of a newspaper that wasn't really a newspaper. Well, National Lampoon did it, too. But yeah, no, that's you know, I just it's wonderful that you wrote for them and you wrote for...
It's that kind of Monty Python-esque news, and I incorporated that into a show. I did a show in New York called Uncle Nat's Traveling Peep Show. And Uncle Nat was a favorite. I mean, it's kind of like Rabbi Saul and Uncle Nat. You guys would get along very well.
Oh, well, I don't get along with anybody, but I might get along part of the time with you, possibly, or Uncle Nat.
When you were a kid, I'm just curious, Rabbi Saul, when you were a kid, did you have a nickname? Because Jewish guys never get good nicknames. Did you notice? Did you ever have a nickname?
They called me Solomoron. That wasn't nice.
Because I say only Italian guys get great nicknames. Jewish guys never get good nicknames because what are you going to call them? Saul Thrifty Schwartz? Who's going to be afraid of a guy named Thrifty, you know? Mike the Mensch Mandelbaum?
There you go.
Nobody cares.
Well, they did call me Schmuck. I got called Schmuck a few times.
Schmuck. Abe the Kibitzer is a good nickname for a guy growing up. The Kibitzer is coming. Watch out.
So wait. But I want to get back to your story, though. First of all, when you're writing for these comedians, did you get to meet them, or were you just sending them lines by mail or by telephone to their agents?
No, I always got to meet them. I only worked with people. It was very rare that I worked just by mail. Once in a while, but with all the ones that I worked with in the beginning, you know, I got to work with some great legends, Milton Berle and Henny Youngman and Jerry Lewis.
All right, wait, stop. So, tell me, what was Jerry Lewis like in those moments when you were actually working? Was he a jerky egotist? Was he fine? What was he like?
Not at all. It was an amazing surprise to me because I didn't know what to expect. I had heard that he might be difficult to deal with. He was the nicest guy in the universe. Well, it was just he and I working together to prepare for his friar's roast. And so I went to his hotel room, and it was just the two of us. Two nights in a row, we worked on material. And I had the most amazing experience while I was there with him because he got a phone call from someone who told him that they found a cure for the Duchenne form of muscular dystrophy. And while I was on the phone with him, he had tears running down his face. He was so overwhelmed.
So he went from being a douchebag to a Duchenne bag, which I thought is kind
of... Yeah, I mean, it was a really wild experience because I had always heard that he was a very difficult guy to deal with. And he couldn't have been nicer. But I think it was the way we met. I was sent to him by the Friars Club by a good friend of his who would arrange for him to be roasted. So he welcomed me with open arms. And then after that, I got to write material for him when he was with Sammy Davis Jr. They had been friends for 40 years, and they were performing together in Las Vegas for the first time. Even though they had been friends for so long, they never performed on the same stage together. And he called me to write material for him. Isn't that cool?
That is really, really... How long ago? This would have been the 70s or the... When was this?
No, this was in the 80s.
80s, okay.
And I think it was the late 80s, maybe early 90s. I got pictures of us in those days.
Oh, my God.
If I hold them up to the phone, maybe your listeners could see them.
It's possible. It's possible.
If I hold them very close to the mic.
Oh my God, look, I can see Sammy's eye, the special eye.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
So, tell us about Rodney Dangerfield.
You know, one time at a Jewish wedding, the rabbi, at the end of the wedding, the rabbi accidentally stepped on Sammy's eye.
Really?
Instead of a glass.
Closest,
they had no glass. He used Sammy's eye.
Oh, right.
It was unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. Nah-ha-ha. Okay, then about...
It was a little piece of comedy trivia that might have gotten past you.
Past Jew? Did you just say past Jew?
Past Jew, exactly.
Tell us about Rodney. What was Rodney Dangerfield like?
Rodney was so fun, man. He was the most fun... It's funny. This past week, I was on NBC talking about this new book, Make 'Em Laugh, and with all the stars that are in it, because everybody came out of the strip. And she said to me, who is the most fun person you ever wrote for? And I'm like, Rodney, for sure. I had the best time. I used to go to his club, and he would hang out in a bathrobe and pajamas, always. But not a fancy bathrobe and pajamas, just an old bathrobe and pajamas.
And smart,
he would walk around the club that way. And he would tell me jokes like, hey, Jeff, you know, what's the difference between Italians and Jews? I said, I don't know, Rodney, what's the difference? He said, well, they both take a leak in the sink, but the Jews take the dishes out first.
That's actually really good. I like that. And it's funny because it's true. There you go.
He was just amazing. You know, he was like, it was just so fun to be there. We would sit in his little office in the club, you know, at the time that I was with him, like... Eventually, he got so famous he couldn't appear in his own club because it didn't hold enough people to handle the kind of crowds that he would draw. But when I knew him, he was doing my stuff on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And one time, he took one of my lines as his opening line on Carson for Johnny Carson. Now, you know, when a comic goes on The Tonight Show, they're very careful what material they use. They go over it and over it, you know.
Sure.
And he took this very simple joke that I wrote for him, and for some reason he loved it so much, and he used it as his opening line. And the joke was, you know, he always had a stock opening. He'd be like, I'm all right now, but last week was rough, you know. He said, I bought one of those whirlpools for my bathtub. The first night I used it, I lost three of my best ships.
It's funny.
He liked that joke so much that he used it for Johnny Carson as his opening line, and I have it on video. I mean, I have a lot of cool stuff from the early days.
Well, now, what's interesting is that also reminds me, and this goes into a little segue here, of a joke that Woody Allen used to tell in the early years about divorcing his wife because, she kept calling him immature, and she was actually the one who was immature because when he was taking a bath, she would come into the bathroom, storm in, and go to the tub and sink his boats. I mean, if you remember that joke, right.
Now, you know,
Woody Allen, that's why I'm doing the segue here.
You know? Woody read my earliest material. back when I was in dental school, I got to meet Woody for a couple of nights. He invited me back. And years later, when I got friendly with Jack Rollins, who is now like 96 and is still Woody's manager, Woody was always managed by Jack Rollins and Charlie Jaffe. And if you look at any Woody Allen movie, it always says at the end, produced by Jack Rollins, you know?
Right, yes.
So I did a movie called I Am Woody, about a mob boss who's obsessed with Woody Allen. And all the gangsters had Jewish names. What happens is this mob boss was a very violent mob boss, but he was obsessed with Woody Allen, and they tried to kill him, and he comes out of it with amnesia. But now he really thinks he's Woody Allen,
right.
But he's 6'5" and 300 pounds. So he's a huge Woody Allen, but he doesn't know he's big. He thinks he's small and thin, and he becomes afraid of his own men. And he gives all his men Jewish names, his sidekick Cheech. He calls him Abe Schneewitz.
Okay.
And the guy's like, I don't want to be Abe Schneewitz. And he pulls out a gun. He goes, you're Abe Schneewitz or I'll kill you. He goes, all right, I'm Abe Schneewitz. And he has to introduce himself to all the other gangsters as Abe Schneewitz. And to get these guys to pronounce Abe Schneewitz, Rabbi, let me tell you what I went through. It was an ordeal. It was a definite ordeal.
Because these were Deutsche actors, I'm sure.
Right, exactly. And you could see this. It's called I Am Woody, and it's on my website at www.jeffreygurian.com. If you want to see funny Italian actors trying to say Abe Schneewitz.
And I would like to see funny Italian actors trying to say Abe Schneewitz. This would amuse me greatly. Now, let me ask you, Jeffrey.
You and I, Abe Schneewitz is easy to say.
Yeah, there's no ch and there's no ts in there. You know,
no.
Right. If it was a ch, if it was like Abe Hochelman, forget it. You would still be rehearsing. Let me tell you.
I would have never got the film done.
Now,
but Schneewitz flows off the tongue.
Well,
it's like music. It's like music to Jews.
It's like mucus to Jews, which also flows off the tongue if you're having a cold.
Exactly.
Now, Jeffrey Gurian is the author, by the way, of Make 'em Laugh, which is 35 years on the comic strip. It's a book that is published by, what is the name of the publisher here? Let me look at the book.
Skyhorse Publishing, a division of Norton.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
It's such a fun book. It's got great stories from people like Ray Romano. Like, for instance, a short story from Ray Romano. Would you know that the first 3 months of his career, he performed under the name Jackie Roberts?
Really?
Did you ever hear that story?
No.
Yeah. What happened was, you know, in New York in comedy, Bud Friedman opened the Improv in 1963. And then at the end of 72, Rick Newman opened Catch a Rising Star. And then the comic strip came along on June 1st of 1976. And on June 17th, Jerry Seinfeld walked into audition. And the first night he was there, they gave him a sign-up sheet in those days. And we have that original sign-up sheet in this book. And they rated him. They said he was good, definitely invite back on Monday, 6/21. And Jerry became an MC within 3 months. There had never been anyone who got to be an MC that quickly at the comic strip.
Right.
Because it was really one of the hardest clubs to pass in New York City. And
by the way, please explain, Jeffrey, please explain what you mean by to pass. There's a whole process. What does that mean, to pass?
What it means is that when you want to perform in a comedy club, you have to go for an audition. And the owner or the booker of the club, or a guy named Lucian Hold, who was a legend in New York, he ran the comic strip for 25 years, they would have to okay you to perform. And that's called passing a club. You have to pass the audition, in other words. So passing at the comic strip was very hard. When Ray Romano started, he went to the Improv first, and they had a lottery system in order to choose who would go on stage that night to perform.
Sure.
And so to double his chances, he brought a friend with him to pick a number also, thinking that if his friend picked the number, he would go up on stage. But he couldn't find a guy. He brought a girl with him. So he said to her, if they pick your number, you got to pick an androgynous name. I can't go up under a girl's name. So, of course, the way the universe works, it was Beshert. They picked her number, right? And she said her name is Jackie Roberts. Putting on stage as Jackie Roberts. He passed the audition, and for the next 3 months, he had to be Jackie Roberts because he was afraid to tell him that he lied, or else he wouldn't be allowed to perform there.
Actually, speaking of which, of not to interrupt, but yeah, hey, yeah. I always interrupt. But
that's okay.
Also, the fear and the wanting to fit in and to being Eddie Murphy. You write in the book that he was also one of the people there in the early days, and he was starting to get a name for himself, but not quite, certainly not big yet. And he almost didn't get his shot at the comic strip. Tell the Eddie Murphy story.
They threw him out the first time he was performing in a trio called the Identical Triplets, two white guys and him. And
actually, those not to interrupt again. Sorry, but those white guys
we
were
do that. Jews, we
famous.
Interrupt.
They were fairly famous comedians too. Who were the other two guys in that?
They were well known. One was, you know, I'm blanking on their names, and I can picture Bob Nelson was one.
Right.
You know who is famous for the football helmet. I can't remember his character, but there was. I can picture their faces. I can't remember their names, but they were known as the Identical Triplets. Both of those guys had been performing at the comic strip, and they suggested that Eddie Murphy comes in. So the night that Eddie came in, they weren't expecting him. He was supposed to come in and see Richie Tinkin. Richie was the owner and the founder and the president of the comic strip. But the night he came in, Richie's partner was there, who didn't expect Eddie. And Eddie walked in all full of himself, and he was expecting to go right up on stage. And when he said to the guy, when am I going on? The guy's like, you go on when I tell you to go on, and if you don't like it, you can leave. And he left.
Oh.
And so he called, his friends called up and like, what happened? You know, Eddie got thrown out of the club. So he said, well, tell Eddie to come back when I'm there, Richie said. So Eddie came back the next week, and Richie said, look, I don't like to go against my partner. But and Eddie was very apologetic. He was saying, Mr. Tinkin, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize, you know. Anyway, he put him on stage, and he killed. And Richie loved him, and he said, listen, don't worry about it. We're going to put you up here. You'll be here as a regular. So after Eddie was there for a while, he asked Richie to manage him. And Richie turned him down because Richie had been a bar owner from the Bronx. He had no experience in management. But Eddie's mother said to Eddie, you need a manager. Who do you trust most in the world? And Eddie said, I trust Richie Tinkin. And she said, then go ask him to manage you. And after about 10 days, Richie gave in, and he managed him. And he managed him from his days on Saturday Night Live all the way up through Beverly Hills Cop 2. They were like father and son. That's how close they were. And together, they discovered Chris Rock in 1986.
Oh my! And Chris Rock, by the way, wrote one of the forewords in the book. It's actually a really wonderful chapter in the book.
The introduction, he wrote a 5-page, hysterically funny introduction, which when I was in Montreal, you know, every year in Montreal is the Just for Laughs Festival.
Yes.
The biggest comedy festival in the world. This past summer was the 30th anniversary. So I brought the book up there with me because everybody knew about it. It hadn't officially come out yet. It didn't come out till October 1st, but I had advanced copies. And so Jay Farrow from Saturday Night Live was there. And, you know, Jay Farrow is amazing when he does impressions. And he does an incredible Chris Rock. And he took the book and he read Chris Rock's introduction in Chris Rock's voice for me and J.B. Smoove, you know, from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Ah, okay, yes.
And I have that video on my Comedy Matters TV channel. Your listeners at the college would be thrilled to hear Jay Farrow. It's so funny. It's so incredibly funny. And again, it's at youtube.com/Gurian News Network. Gurian News Network. And you'll see Jay Farrow doing Chris Rock reading this introduction in Chris's voice.
Now here's one thing that I'm still not that clear. It's clear in the book, but explain what your job was, how you were connected to the comic strip comedy club. You weren't an owner. What are you? Yeah.
Well, I am Richie's creative partner. Let's say Richie Tinkin and I have forged a creative partnership where we come up with projects to promote this legendary club. I suggested the book to him, as I said, back in 2008, and I performed there. I host on Sunday and Monday night, but I had been connected to the club for years because I've been a comedy writer for such a long time.
Right.
and I know so many people in the business. And the comic strip had just always been a favorite of mine when Lucian Hold was running it for 25 years. You know, when Richie was managing Eddie, he spent most of his time in Los Angeles. But I was always a New York guy. I was always here. And so I used to spend a lot of time at the strip. And I was very friendly with Lucian, who unfortunately passed away around 2005. You know, but he was the face of the club. Everyone thought he actually owned the club. And Richie didn't mind that. When Eddie Murphy came in 1986, you might enjoy this story.
Yeah.
Eddie was the biggest star in the world at the time. He was like the Elvis of comedy. And he walked in, and they were always thrilled when he was there. The audience would be like in awe that Eddie Murphy was there.
Sure.
So he comes in one night and he says, "Are there any black comics I can see?" And in those days, believe it or not, there were hardly any black comics. Chris Rock was 19 years old, hardly had any experience at all, and he was setting up chairs in the club in exchange for stage time. They let him go on late at night, like 2 in the morning, for 6 people, right? But he was the only one there. So they decided to put Chris up. And Chris knew that Eddie was there, and Eddie was his idol. And Chris goes on in front of 200 people. The place was packed. It was a Friday night. First time he ever went before such a big audience. And he crushed. He totally killed it. And he heard Eddie laughing off to the side. And Eddie was waiting for him when he got off stage. And they sat together for like an hour talking. And Eddie gave him his phone number. Took him to Los Angeles to see him do reshoots for the movie Golden Child. And then gave him a part in Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Wow.
And that's what made his career. Isn't that cool?
That's the way, you know, there's a portion or I forget who's being interviewed in the book, Make 'em Laugh, but they talk about this thing of just being there. As I, when the comics would go to the comic strip, it wasn't just about hanging out for like 20 minutes or 40 minutes until your time to go on and then do your set and then leave. It was really about being there day after day, hanging with the comics, the other talking with them, watching everybody, staying until 2 or 3 in the morning and then coming back. It was paying your dues, but it was also marinating in the culture of being a stand-up comic. And if you did it long enough and you had some talent, that was when things would just, they would happen when it was time to happen.
When it was time to happen, exactly. And it was Paul Reiser that told that story because he said Jerry Seinfeld suggested to him that he hang out more because Paul was living with his parents, like I think in New Jersey, and he was running back and forth all the time because his father wanted him to be in his business and he didn't want him to be a comedian. So he wasn't hanging out much. And Jerry said to him, "Look, you got to be here, man. You have to be at the club," because they lived at the club. Seinfeld was there like every night, and he would bring in, Paul said he would bring in a piece of paper with 3 ideas on it every night, new ideas, and he would develop them on stage. And so it was Jerry that encouraged Paul to start hanging out, because he said, once you hang out, you become part of the group, and then the other comics give you gigs. If they get a gig and they can't make it, they give it to you, and there's a camaraderie there. And that's how that brunch started, you know. I don't know if you guys know, but every January 1st for the last 30 years, Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, Mark Schiff, and Larry Miller get together in Brooklyn, and they go out to brunch, and they walk over the Brooklyn Bridge. Did you know that?
No, I did not. I was never invited, you know. It would have been nice.
Well, next year you will be.
Thank you, David.
Next year in Jerusalem and in Brooklyn.
But same thing. Really, parts of Brooklyn are just like Jerusalem.
Just like Jerusalem. And that started, you know, New Year's Eve of 1980. Paul told the story. He said when he came to the comic strip, he was dating a comedian named Carol Leifer.
Right.
And the next thing he knew, Jerry Seinfeld was dating Carol Leifer. And he never really knew how that happened, but it created some awkwardness. So the night before New Year's of 1980, he walked over to Jerry, and he put out his hand, and he said, "Let's put this Carol thing behind us. We should be friends." And Jerry shook his hand, and that started a lifelong friendship. And the next day, they started their 30-year annual brunch. Isn't that cool?
I think it's wonderful. It's sort of a modern-ish extension of the Friars Club that you're talking about, of the camaraderie.
In a sense, it is. And this is all these stories and so many, many more are available in this book. You could get it on Amazon.com. Do they have Barnes & Noble out in Colorado?
They have Barnes & Noblewitz in the town where I stay when I'm up in New York.
Beautiful. Right. Yeah, if they have that, because in New York it's in all the Barnes & Nobles, but it's on Amazon.com. And, you know, if your comedy fan listeners get it, I would love it if they would leave a comment on Amazon. Because Amazon, it's amazing how they value rankings by the comments that they get. So far, I have all 5-star comments. People love this book.
I will give you a 6-star rating then.
A 6-star.
I'll push you over the top.
Can the 6-star be a Jewish star?
It's a Mogan David rating. I didn't think of that, but yes, there you go.
We're talking 5 stars plus the star of David.
Exactly. We're talking with Jeffrey Gourion. By the way, it is 11:02 in the morning here, Mountain Time, on UNC Radio, the radio station of the University of Northern Colorado, listenable at uncradio.com. You're listening to the Dave's Gone By radio program. We just have a couple more minutes left with the hilarious Jeffrey Gourion. Now, Jeffrey, there's a thing on your website. There's a video of you getting these clips from all these famous people, all these famous comedians are saying, hi, this is so-and-so, and you're watching comedy TV. How many of these kinds of interviews with these all these famous comedians do you have on video that people can watch? Like 10 minutes. It seems to me your TV show.
I have over 160 videos right now of celebrity interviews with people like Jimmy Fallon and Judah Friedlander and Nick Kroll. I'm going to be on Nick Kroll's new show on Comedy Central in January. He's got a new show called Kroll Show, and I'm friends with comedians of all ages. So it's all on that channel, on my Comedy Matters TV channel. It's on YouTube.com/Gourion.
Shalom. Shalom.
Shalom.
Are you here? Are you there?
I'm still here.
Oh, you're still here.
I heard a click, but I'm also on Twitter at Jeffrey Gourion because everybody likes to tweet. I'm going to be tweeting about your show. I'm on Facebook, Jeffrey Gourion, Gourion. And come visit me on my site, jeffreygourion.com, and they'll see. It opens up on that video, that super sizzle reel, and they'll see John Mulaney from Saturday Night Live. All the people that they watch on TV.
Now, let me ask you last question. I wish we had a little more time, but I do have one question of how do you, and a terrible question actually to ask, but how do you actually go about writing a joke? It's one thing to write funny for character. That's a whole different sort of thing. But to actually just start from nothing and have a joke with a punchline, is there a method to it? How does that work?
Yeah, well, it took me about a year to learn, actually. It's like a science, but it comes to you. It's the way you see the world. You know, comedians see the world in a different way. That's why audiences laugh, because they relate to it. You're telling them about things that they've seen all their lives, but they never looked at it with your perspective. So physically writing a joke, you have to write a premise, and then you have to write a punchline, and you have to do it in as few words as possible.
Sure.
When you see beginners, you know, like one of the best jokes I ever wrote was for Rodney, and he said, you know, I went to one of those custom bed shops, and I asked the salesman, what kind of bed would you recommend for a guy like me? He said, single.
Cute. Okay.
Now, that was just a one-word punchline, but that was such a powerful joke, you know, single. You know, you have to take the essence of the humor and put it in as few words as possible. So how you write a joke is how a songwriter writes a song. It just comes to you. I think of things all the time, all throughout the day. I keep a pad with me or a recorder, and I'm always writing down things that strike me funny. And for some reason, I have the ability. I can just go home and write jokes. For my own act, I can just sit down and write. If somebody needs jokes, they just come to me. I don't know how, but I can see things in a different way.
Now,
I hope that is some kind of an answer to your question.
Oh, no, that's a very, very good, and as good an answer as you can get for something that is a creative process that can't necessarily be explained. So I appreciate that very much. Can I ask you also, since you're still there at the comic strip, and the comic strip is still there, even though so many of these other clubs are no longer.
It's the only one that still exists in New York from those days. The other two have long closed. You know, the Improv is out in L.A. with Bud, And Catch a Rising Star is franchised around the country, but it no longer exists as a club in New York. So the comic strip is still going strong. Now it's the 36th year.
Mazel.
And it's amazing. It's busy all the time. All the big stars come in. There's a photo of Dave Chappelle reading the book. Dave came in recently to do a spot. Judah Friedland is there all the time. Colin Quinn drops by. Gilbert Gottfried. They all come in.
Wonderful. Well, is Stand Up New York still there, or is that gone too?
Stand Up is there on 78th and Broadway, sure. It's been totally remodeled. New owner, Gabe Waldman, you know.
Well, Cary Hoffman is busy.
A nice Jewish guy. Cary Hoffman is out a long time.
Right, he's doing the Sinatra stuff now. He moved
to... he's touring his Sinatra with his band.
Right, well, yeah, he's doing a show, I think, still off Broadway, actually. We interviewed him here a couple of years ago about Stand Up New York, so I'm trying to get...
Rick Newman just opened up a new theater on 72nd Street, the Triad Theater, that's going to have comedy, music, and all kinds of entertainment. So there's so much going on in New York City. You wouldn't believe it for such a small city like New York, that there's so much going on, right?
So let me ask you a final question for the wonderful and hilarious Jeffrey Gourion. Since you're there as the MC still at the comic strip, what is it, Sundays and Mondays?
Sunday and Monday nights. Yeah, I do the late show.
Who are the up and comers that we haven't heard yet? Whom you think maybe in a year or two will be, you know, the ones that we'll all be talking about? They'll start to get name recognition. They might get a sitcom. Who's the next bigger things in comedy?
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. I have a chapter in the book called The Next Generation, and it's about the stars that are coming out of the club, like Ted Alexandro, John Fish, Brian Scott McFadden, Marina Franklin. Colin Jost is there all the time. You know, he's now the head writer on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, my goodness.
But making a real name for himself as a stand-up comic. Mike Vecchione is hysterical. Pete Davidson. Jordan Rock, who's Chris Rock's baby brother, 21 years old, is now performing there. You know, it's Chris. Tony Rock is also Chris's brother. Chris is the oldest of the three. You know, there are seven brothers. Three of them are now in comedy. Tony is the new host of Jamie Foxx's show, Live at the Apollo. And Jordan Rock performs with me at the comic strip almost every night.
Like, it's like a whole rock concert there.
It's a rock concert. The rock comedy empire.
Wow.
It's unbelievable.
Well,
so those are the new guys that are coming up.
Well, I'm glad that there's new people, but also wonderful older people who know the history and care about the history and are still out there doing it. And that includes the delightful Jeffrey Gourion. Everybody, please get his book, Make 'em Laugh. 35 years of the comic strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. I should say it's co-written by you and Richie Tinkin, and it's available from Sky Horse Publications, and you can get it pretty much everywhere, and especially from the website. Tell us one more time, Jeffrey.
My website is www.jeffreygourion.com, JeffreyGurian.com. It's available on the Comic Strip website at comicstriplive.com. You can get it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Probably any big bookstore in Colorado will have it. And you can call the rabbi if you need it, and I'll make sure you get one if you have any trouble. That's all.
Great.
Rabbi Saul is my new connection in Colorado.
That's right. We'll talk. You'll do for me. You scratch my back, and I'll scratch your tuchus. That's kind of how it works. There it goes.
That's how it works.
Jeffrey, I want to thank you so much. You've been absolutely so much fun to talk to. It's been wonderful. I want to get you back on here in a few weeks, too. I think we can have so much fun.
Anytime, Rabbi. I would love to come on. I had a great time with you. It's a fabulous show, and I wish all your listeners a Zisen Pesach.
It's a little early for that, but mit Mazel and mit Glick to you. Thank you so much, Jeffrey Gourion. Bye-bye
now. My pleasure. Bye-bye now.